I wanted to just remind you briefly where we are. Yesterday we were talking about Rendler space and understanding the physics behind the Unruh effect. What we discovered was we could define two interesting, well, many interesting states for a free, say, massless quantum field theory on Minkowski space, but two were of particular interest. One is the usual Minkowski vacuum, which is a lovely state, fully translationally invariant, Poincaré invariant, smooth. You can define the some sort of renormalized stress energy tensor in it, and it has beautiful physical properties. We also found, however, that it was sometimes of interest to discuss something we called the Rendler vacuum. Okay? Now, this was not such a nice physical state, and we identified a particular way in which it is physically singular. In particular, we noticed that if you take the expectation value of the renormalized stress energy tensor in the Rendler vacuum, that the Rendler vacuum has a negative energy, which is the same kind of negative energy you'd have if you just had minus the energy of a thermal bath in a gravitational field. And in particular, because this is because Minkowski space in Rendler coordinates has a gravitational field, has a non-zero redshift or blueshift, and that blueshift, in fact, grows, it diverges as you approach what's called the Rendler horizon, which is just this light cone. What that means is that this negative energy density diverges to become minus infinity on the horizon. So that's a sense in which this state is physically singular. If you don't like that term, you might say that, well, if we happen to be given a quantum field theory in the Rendler vacuum, then it would never be a good approximation to neglect gravitational effects because there's a diverging energy density in the spacetime. Okay. Nevertheless, we found that it was sometimes useful to think about this state as a reference for certain calculations. In particular, we found that the Minkowski vacuum state could be written as a kind of thermal excitation over the Rendler vacuum, in just such a way that the Minkowski vacuum has zero expectation value for the stress energy tensor. So if it's a thermal state above the Rendler vacuum, then the Minkowski vacuum gets two pieces to its stress energy, one from the Rendler vacuum itself, minus TAV thermal, and then an extra thermal piece, which cancels it exactly. And that was a useful way of thinking, because we found that if we have, for example, a uniformly accelerated observer in this space-time, and if they would carry with them some kind of particle detector, say a small piece of the LHC or some such thing, then instead of finding results for particle experiments as if they were in a vacuum state, instead of finding the same results that an inertial observer would find, they find the kind of results for their experiments that an inertial observer would find if indeed they were in a thermal state. Okay, so that's our story so far. What I want to do today is a one-day broad overview of the similar story involving black holes and Hawking radiation. Now, obviously, we don't have time to do any detailed calculations, but what I want to do is concentrate on getting a physical picture of what's going on with the story of Hawking radiation and some of the usual discussions associated with it. And we're going to work basically by analogy with Rendler space, because, as every good relativist knows, there's not a lot of difference between a black hole and Rendler space. Okay, and we're going to use that analogy today. So before I get into this, let me just pause to see if there are any questions left over about this story that I should answer before moving on, because we're going to rely on our knowledge of Rendler space to talk about black holes. Yes? So the question is about if you express the Minkowski state as a thermal excitation over the Rendler vacuum, we found that the Minkowski state was given by some normalization constant times some expression in terms of sums of creation operators times the Rendler vacuum. And the question was about this normalization constant. And indeed, if you do the calculation, that diverges for this Bogdan-Lubov transformation, which tells us, as we said the other day, that the Rendler vacuum and the Minkowski vacuum don't really live in the same Hilbert space, okay? Which, if you like, is perhaps another way of saying that the Rendler vacuum itself is, in some sense, singular. At least it's very different from any state in the Fock space. That's right. So because of this fact that it doesn't live in the same Hilbert space, if you like, that you could say that there's a kind of super selection rule between them. Nothing, physics will never transition, will never spontaneously decay from the Minkowski vacuum to the Rindler vacuum. That's right. Actually, if I had hoped to say a bit more about that story, but I ran out of time yesterday. So feel free to ask me about that again during the question sessions, or if for some reason I finish early today. There's an interesting way of drawing out that physical discussion. OK, anything else pressing before we move on? OK, so, well, I'm not going to do any detailed calculations about black holes, but I am going to draw lots of pictures today. So I hope that you're all familiar with the conformal diagram, also called the Carter-Penrose diagram, for a black hole in asymptotically flat space. So let's see. Here's infinity. There's a singularity. There's a horizon. And what I'm drawing here is the conformal diagram for, as you all, I'm sure, are aware, these lines are supposed to be 45-degree lines, so that these are right angles. And I hope that your artwork is better than mine. And I'm drawing here the conformal diagram for a Schwarzschild black hole, say, in 3 plus 1 dimensions to be definite. OK? So let's see. Is this diagram largely familiar, or should I stop to explain something about it? OK. The important thing to remember is just that, really, over here is the asymptotically flat region of space-time. Infinity is out here at these edges. This is what is called scry minus, or minus past null infinity. This is scry plus, past future infinity. I can't draw scries, so I just write eyes. And of course, these here are the future horizon and past horizon, the black hole. And of course, what we notice immediately is it does look an awful lot like that picture over there on the blackboard of Rindler space. OK. So I want to run our discussion for black holes somewhat in a similar manner to the Rindler space discussion. I want to first phrase it in terms of mathematics to give us some language and some tools to discuss things with. I want to just ask a mathematical question. If I look at this space-time, and I were to think about doing the quantum field theory of, say, a free scalar field, for example, if I were to pick out, well, how might I look at this space-time and pick out particularly interesting bases for the space of solutions? That is to say, what are particularly interesting notions of, say, positive frequency in this space-time? Or, said differently, again, an analogy with our Rindler discussion, what are particularly interesting sets of observers in this space-time to whom we might wish to want to adapt various notions of positive frequency and bases? So, any suggestions? OK. Well, OK. So one of our favorite things to do is to talk about people who live off at infinity and look at the black holes. So choice number one would be some sort of observers who live off at infinity. And I presume what you meant was to think about inertial observers at infinity. OK, those are interesting sets of observers. And in fact, we can generalize that family of observers and move away from infinity actually in a couple of different ways. So let's talk about that. One of the reasons you might be interested in inertial observers at infinity is that they are out in the flat region, where space is asymptotically flat. And so you would expect them to have some usual notions of energy and momentum, et cetera. Let's focus on energy. OK. Energy is a well-defined concept in a black hole space-time because there, any energy of some field propagating on the black hole space-time is well-defined because there is a time translation symmetry. This space-time is static. So what does that mean? It means that there is a symmetry which, in this picture, does this. It's a time translation, like so. And drawn near the horizon, it does this. So what's interesting about it is that it is, of course, a time translation out here. But if we extend this symmetry to the rest of the space-time, it does something a little bit funny. It becomes a space-like symmetry in these regions. And if I want to define a complete symmetry, it runs in the past time-like direction on the other side. So out here at infinity, this is just the time translation that translates us along the world lines of inertial observers. Let's see. Oops, that's not an eraser. That's a box of chalk. So just to, instead of talking about observers at infinity, because what I'd like to have is a, well, let me generalize this notion or extend it into the interior by saying that one family of observers we might discuss would be what are called static observers. So what's a static observer? Static observer is just someone who moves along, whose world line flows along the curves of this symmetry. Okay? So to them, the black hole appears to be not changing in time. Everything appears to be static. Okay. That's one set of observers we might look at, which in particular includes inertial observers near infinity. Well, it includes approximately, I guess I should say, approximately inertial observers. Okay. Yes, so this is the usual picture where each point in this diagram represents a two-sphere. In that sense, it's rotationally symmetric. I lost my student on the slide. Yes. So this is the maximal extension of the Schwarzschild black hole, or the so-called Kruskal extension, which has the somewhat unphysical feature that it has two asymptotic regions connected by a wormhole throat. Okay. Can I draw what? I just did. Constant time slices. Oh, you mean on this picture. So, well, depends what you want to call time, but here is a Cauchy surface for this space-time, which has the property that it is at some constant value of what's called the killing time. If I'd drawn this correctly, this surface was supposed to pass through the point where these horizons cross, and if I'd done that, well, it doesn't quite work, but if I'd drawn it through the center there, then this surface would, in fact, be orthogonal to this killing vector field that I've drawn. So in that sense, it's a, I assume that's what you meant by a constant time slice. And if you ask what does the spatial geometry on that slice look like, it looks something like this. As I say, it's the usual story where there are two asymptotically flat regions connected by some sort of wormhole throat. The wormhole is down here in the middle. Okay. So we'll start with this case because it's a simple case to look at, and then we'll eventually talk about what happens in dynamic collapsing black holes. When I say inertial, I mean freely falling. How about that? Better? As you say, depending on what language one uses, inertial may only be a well-defined concept actually at infinity, so let's not worry about that. But as good relativists, we like freely falling observers because they're locally inertial. Or I could have said locally inertial. Okay. Yes? You mean if I reflect this? It's true that there's a Z2 symmetry in this space-time, which exchanges these two regions, which reverses the direction of time, of the time translation. That's right. But there's no rotational symmetry that does that. There's no preferred axis in the space-time. Again, the story is that each point here represents its two sphere. So you should think of the black hole space-time as being the metric product of S2 with this diagram. Okay. All right. Sorry, I didn't build in a long discussion about black holes. I was assuming everyone's basically familiar with this picture and how it works. So we'll press on in order to do a little bit of quantum field theory. Okay, so perhaps by your question, you're telling me this wasn't quite the family of observers you had in mind. There's another family which is natural, which is to consider observers that are free, so the static observers are not freely falling. They're sitting there in a gravitational field and they're not falling. So they need some sort of rocket ship or platform to keep them out of the black hole, or a long rope or something like that. Or they need to be in orbit around the black hole. Well, they're not static, sorry. If they're really static, they need to be hanging from a rope from infinity, standing on a platform, or using some rocket to keep them out of the black hole. So you might be interested in other observers, which might seem more natural to any relativist in the audience, which are observers that are freely falling more generally. All right. So this would be an observer that, oh, I don't know, it might start out here near infinity, and then might, I don't want to draw any additional lines on my blackboard, but might just come in here and fall into the black hole and go inside. So as was pointed out, if we compare these two classes of observers near infinity, they coincide. The interesting difference comes in the interior. And in fact, the region that we might be most interested in for the black hole is the horizon itself. So maybe the set of observers which is most interesting to consider are those that are freely falling near the horizon. Right? After all, it's observers that are freely falling through the horizon that have what we relativists usually think of as the best description of the local physics at the horizon, because it's in terms of such observers that we can write locally flat coordinates and describe the space-time as being locally Minkowski space, right? Okay. So we want to think about these two classes of observers, and let's just imagine, for the moment, how we might set up some basis in the space of solutions to the scalar wave equation, which is natural for each set of observers. Yes, question. Sorry, these world lines, if these start outside the horizon, they never intersect the horizon. Because these are observers that, for which nothing ever changes as time passes. So if you like, their distance from the black hole in any invariant way you can measure it remains constant. Okay. All right. Static observers are ones that see the space-time as not changing with time. These observers do see the space-time to be changing with time in a sort of intrinsic way, because of course, as they progress along their world line, they move from a region of the space-time where the curvature is low up through the horizon towards the singularity to a region of space-time where the curvature is large. So, is that clear? Good. All right. So we'd like to think about how we would write down, at least in principle, some set of modes associated with each observer. So perhaps, as with the Rindler case, we'd like to think about how we might write down a set of modes which is positive frequency in some natural sense associated with the proper time of static observers, or conversely, associated with the proper time of freely falling observers near the horizon. So to do that, we'll need to introduce some coordinates. I'll draw this picture again because it's getting a little bit cluttered. Let's do it here. I'll try to do it a little bit better this time. Like so. Well, okay, a little bit better. All right. So what kind of coordinates might we want to introduce? Well, maybe it's clear what kind of time coordinate is most naturally associated with the static observers, because after all, these folks are defined by a symmetry, a time translation symmetry, or at least something which is locally a time translation out near infinity. So it's natural to introduce a time coordinate, which is just the time coordinate associated with that time translation symmetry. So imagine that, let's see, we'll let t be what's called the killing time, which just means it's some coordinate which is defined by the fact that if you act with the time translation symmetry, you advance this coordinate by a certain amount. Well, we also have to say something about where the coordinate is zero, but we'll also just choose t to be constant on surfaces like the one I drew here, which are orthogonal to the time translation. Okay, so this is the usual killing time. And recall that this is that out near infinity, where the spacetime becomes flat, this is going to be like the Minkowski time coordinate near infinity. Okay. Now, what I'd really like to do, in order to match the discussion to my Rindler discussion, is to talk not about a time coordinate, but to talk about null coordinates. Well, that's not too hard. If we're out here near infinity, then it's natural to also talk about some radial coordinate, which matches the radial coordinate of Minkowski space near infinity. And so we can introduce null coordinates, and I've called them little u and little v. V is, again, t plus r, and u is t minus r. Now, what do those, let's only worry about defining these coordinates near infinity for the moment. Let's not worry about what they're like in the interior. How can I draw them on this diagram? Well, they're null coordinates, so they label null rays. So there are two families of null rays. There are or null surfaces. There are incoming null surfaces that come into the spacetime this way, and there are outgoing null surfaces. So with this convention, v is a coordinate that, little v, is a coordinate that increases along past infinity, and little u is a coordinate that increases along future infinity. Okay? And these guys have names. These coordinates are called the affine parameters along past and future infinity. All that means is that the natural null coordinates that you would use if the spacetime was flat there, which it approximately is. Okay. So that gives us two null coordinates in the spacetime that are associated with the static observers. Okay. Well, how about the freely falling observers? Yes. I'm sorry, I can't hear you. The what? Oh, the pink lines are the, they're the orbits of this time translation. I'm sorry, can I draw what? This kind of diagram for number two? So these folks have some notion of time, but it's not associated with the symmetry. Okay, so I cannot draw a symmetry acting on the entire space-time for those folks. Let me show you what I can draw, okay? Let me get there in a second. All right? Yes. That's correct. All right. So what can I do for the freely falling observers? Okay. Well, what I would like to do is to imagine looking at some place where they cross the horizon. So here's a place where one observer is falling across the horizon. And I'd like to imagine going to locally inertial coordinates there, the coordinates in which the metric appears to be flat space plus second order corrections. Okay? Then, in this two-dimensional model where I've suppressed the spheres, I can certainly talk about a time and a distance coordinate and introduce the corresponding null coordinates. You can imagine doing this. We're not going to do it explicitly. Okay? It turns out that there's a simple answer to what the result is. These null coordinates that you build in flat space are characterized by being what we call in general relativity affine parameters along null geodesics, or along null rays. Is this a term which is familiar to the audience, an affine parameter? If not, if you're not familiar with an affine parameter is the equivalent of proper time, but in a null direction. So the long and short of it is, I know what the answer is going to be for these null coordinates without going through any long calculations. The answer is that natural null coordinates associated with the freely falling observers near the horizon are just the affine parameters along the horizon. Okay. So let me introduce those two things. One is a null coordinate, which I will have increase this way, and I will call capital V. And the other is a null coordinate, that I will increase this way, and I will call capital U. Okay? And again, the way these are defined, although I'm not going to write down the equations or do it exactly, is that you just imagine these freely falling observers crossing the horizon and asking them what's the natural, asking each one to identify a time direction and a space direction, and to build out of that combinations that are like t plus or minus r. Okay. So this is nice. This is a nice way to characterize the problem, because you see there's a natural way to map little v into capital V, and to map little u into capital U. As I say, it's natural to think about these coordinates as labeling, not just points at past infinity or points in the future horizon. You can think about them as labeling null surfaces . In this case, I've drawn the ingoing null surfaces. And so that puts some sort of correspondence between little v and capital V. It says if we think about matching things up along null surfaces, capital V is just a function of little v. And similarly, if we use outgoing null surfaces, we could write capital U as a function of little u. Okay. So what is the answer for that function? Well, it is a standard result that I hope you might have seen if you've taken a full GR course. That this relationship takes a simple form, and just to get the signs right, the answer is that capital V, the affine parameter along the horizon, is exactly the exponential of a constant kappa times little v, the affine parameter along infinity. And similarly, capital U is e to the kappa little u. Now, these expressions should look somewhat familiar, because they are exactly the same functional relationship that we saw between the Rindler time coordinates and the Minkowski time coordinates in Rindler space. Yes? Sorry, what? So I've only defined them here near infinity. And if you ask me what they are in the interior, what I'm saying here is let us extend them into the interior using these null surfaces. My intention was to simply draw this picture, and therefore I do not need to introduce the coordinate r star, but it is equivalent to the usual tortoise coordinates. It's the same thing, but merely with less algebra and less equations. Indeed. Okay. So. It turns out this is no coincidence. This kind of relationship follows in general whenever you have a killing symmetry, whenever you have a symmetry like this, which acts locally like a boost. Okay. In fact, if you think hard about it, this is really the statement that if you do a boost, which is a translation on capital U and capital V, no, sorry. A boost is a translation on little u and little v, because a boost is the one which is nice out here, which is a time translation near infinity, that boost rescales multiplicatively null vectors at the origin. Right? That's a familiar concept from Minkowski space. If I do a boost, it rescales a null vector, right? If I do a boost in a two-dimensional Minkowski space, it rescales the corresponding null vectors. That's exactly this statement. The boost is a translation in capital U and capital V, sorry, in little u and little v, and that simply rescales capital U and capital V. So this kind of relationship holds whenever you have this boost-like killing field. All right. Excuse me? These are coordinates. But of course, if I were to consider the vector that in some sense stretches from an origin out to some point, or if I did the same calculation in the tangent space, I get a rescaling of the vectors. But these are coordinates. Okay. Now, what's interesting, the only difference between this case and the Rindler case, though, is that in the Rindler case, kappa was an arbitrary constant. And why was kappa arbitrary? It was arbitrary because we didn't have a particularly natural place to normalize the Rindler time translation. We could choose it to be a unit time translation along this uniformly accelerating observer's world line, or we could have chosen it to be a unit time translation along another uniformly accelerating observers worldwide. But in this case, we have a natural normalization. We'd like to use the time translation, which is associated with the usual concept of energy. So we want the one which is normalized out at infinity. The observers far away see this as just a unit time translation. So for a black hole, kappa is a definite number. And in particular, as an example, for a 3 plus 1 Schwarzschild, kappa is 1 over 4 pi m. And in general, kappa has a name. It's called the surface gravity of the black hole. So you'll see in many discussions of Hawking radiation, this concept of surface gravity. And if you wonder what it is and how it comes into the game, a simple way to understand it is that it's just the concept entered into these expressions that relates the natural notion of a null coordinate at infinity to a null coordinate along the horizon. OK. All right. Good. So at this point, you can see that we're going to have a story very similar, or at least in some way analogous to, our story in Rindler space. In fact, if I considered a massless field, massless scalar, and if I imagine this space-time without the spheres, in other words, if I imagine this space-time, i.e., a 1 plus 1 model, okay, or I just delete the spheres and I just think about this 1 plus 1 picture, then we'd be done. Because the massless wave equation in 1 plus 1 dimensions always looks like du dv phi equals 0, or actually in any equivalently, d capital U d capital V phi equals 0. So I could immediately solve that equation in terms of modes that are just e to the I omega V, e to the I omega U, for both capital U and little u. And I could work out the Bogolyubov transformation because it would be exactly the same calculation that we did in Rindler space. Right? If I had this simplified model where I delete the spheres and had this simple version of a wave equation, and if I just compared e to the I omega little v with e to the I omega capital V, then because little v and capital V are related by the same expression we had over here, the Bogolyubov transformation is the same. Right? So in this simplified model, you get exactly the same result. Now, of course, if we can really considering a 3 plus 1 dimensional space-time, we have to worry about these spheres. And that means that this is not the wave equation. So in the real world, this is not the right wave equation. And these things are not exact solutions to the wave equation. There are some modifications. Okay. But the modifications are of a type we can understand qualitatively. Because imagine, for example, that we chose a mode that looked like this, e to the I omega v. Let's do the other way. One that looks like e to the I omega little v. Suppose we chose a mode that looked like that in terms of the initial data down here at past infinity. That's allowed. We can choose the initial data freely. So why not choose a mode that looks like that at the starting time? Okay. Then our task is simply to propagate that solution forward and see what it does. Right? And why does it not stay exactly e to the I omega little v? It's because there's some scattering in the space-time. The wave goes in. There's some sort of curvature that generates an effective potential, which I could write down if I had more time and so forth. But it's going to generate some effective potential. And there'll be some kind of scattering. So part of the wave will go through, and part of it will backscatter to infinity. Okay. So in the real world, or in the full 3 plus 1 case, there's also scattering. which modifies the solution. Okay? But let me ask you this. If I have a black hole sitting there in space, and I throw something at it, and let's say I throw it directly at the black hole, and I throw a small object at the black hole, I throw this eraser at the black hole, right? How much does it scatter? In other words, if I throw this eraser straight at a black hole, is it likely to go in? Yes. I said, that's right, I'm sorry. I was thinking of this eraser in an astrophysical black hole. So the black hole is much larger than the eraser. But that's exactly the point I wanted to make. So at least in certain regimes, the scattering will be small. If I consider a fairly high frequency mode with small angular momentum propagating in and out towards a black hole, the scattering will be small. Okay? If the black hole was smaller than the wavelength of whatever I'm scattering, then the scattering will be large. That's right. But in there, some regime it's small. So let's focus on that regime for the moment. I'll comment on the other regime later. Okay. We're trying to press forward here. Okay. So therefore, we expect that at least qualitatively, the results are very similar for the real problem, at least for high frequency things scattering off the black hole. Okay. So let's think about what that means. It means that there is a Bogoliubov transformation between the two associated states, which is somehow thermal. Okay. Great. Am I here yet? Let me write down the two possible states. So we could have a black hole state associated with the, oh gosh, I just erased the coordinates. That's too bad, because now I'm going to get confused. Let's see. Capital V was this one, and little v was this one. So there's the state associated with the static observers, which we might call the vacuum defined by little u and little v. That's one of the options. And there's also the state associated with our freely falling observers near the horizon. And that's the vacuum which is associated with coordinates capital U and capital V. And what we've learned, well, let's see what we've learned. I said the Bogoliubov transformation must be thermal. But let's sort out with this, at least roughly thermal, by analogy with the Rindler calculation. But let's trace the analogy more carefully. So let's look at the analogous Rindler state. That's bad language. Analogous state on Minkowski space. And Minkowski space near the horizon, because that's the interesting region. Okay, so what's the analogous state? Well, recall that these coordinates, capital U and V, are the ones that were associated with this symmetry. And the symmetry acts like the boost near the horizon. So which of our two states over here is the one that we defined using a notion of positive frequency defined by the boost symmetry, by the Rindler time translation? Well, it's this one, right? This is the one that we defined using the modes that were decomposed into positive and negative frequency using the Rindler time translation, which is the boost near the horizon. So in the analogy here, this is like the Rindler vacuum. Whereas this one is the one associated with the affine parameter. The affine parameter is the one, remember, associated with, is like proper time. It's associated with inertial notions of time. So this one is like the Minkowski vacuum. So just to get the sign right, what it means is when we port over our Bogoliubov transformation from Rinder space, what it says is that it's this vacuum, which is, roughly speaking, something we can view as a thermal excitation over the other vacuum. Okay. In other words, if we haven't, so far we're just listing various possible states. We haven't actually said which one ought to be the correct quantum state for a field theory on a black hole background. But if we happen to have a quantum field in this state, what it means is that if you were a static observer, or in particular, if you were a inertial observer out near infinity, and you went around detecting particles, you would find that there is a thermal flux of particles in this state. So if you're just an inertial observer out here at infinity with your particle detector, you find that there's a set of thermal excitations around you if the quantum field theory is actually in this particular state. At this point, I want to go back and pick up on this question about scattering, which is what I've argued so far was that in the regime where scattering is not important, say at high frequencies, the result should be thermal. Okay. It turns out that the result is in fact exactly thermal in all cases, but when properly understood. Okay. The story is this. Imagine that I had not a black hole, but I had instead some kind of star surrounded by its gravitational field, as, of course, a star is surrounded by its gravitational field, right? Now, what kind of radiation does a star emit, supposing it's a perfect thermal equilibrium? Does a star emit black body radiation? Well, more or less. It certainly emits black body radiation, well, assuming it's a perfect black body. A real star, of course, has spectral lines and all kinds of other junk with it, but let's suppose it was actually, it is somehow a perfect black body, except that it's surrounded by its gravitational field. Well, that would mean that it emits black body radiation here, black body radiation. But to reach, say, some observer at infinity, that radiation has to propagate through the gravitational field. And therefore, that radiation also exhibits some kind of scattering off of the gravitational potential in general. Some of it scatters back towards the star, some goes out. The higher frequency radiation goes right through, the longer frequency radiation exhibits more backscatter. Okay. So this is simply to say that the same kind of scattering coefficients are relevant not only in computing this Bogoliubov transformation for Hawking radiation, but they're the same kind of coefficients that come up if you compute what you actually see if you stand off at infinity and watch a black body inside a gravitational field. Okay. Now, that's not a proof of my next statement, but that should make you feel comfortable with the claim I'm going to make, that it turns out that taking into account such scattering effects, which are called in the business gray body factors, which just means that if you're looking at the black body through its gravitational field, black body radiation is not what's detected out here at infinity. It's some distorted version called gray body radiation. Okay. So the claim that I'm going to make is that, in fact, if you do the full details and take all that into account, this Bogoliubov transformation really does contain thermal radiation in the sense of containing exactly the right gray body factors. Okay. The way that's proven is by using the right kind of Euclidean techniques, which we didn't have time to go through here, but which you can see if you have a look at the lecture notes I recommended by Ted Jacobson or by Simon Ross. But I mentioned that. Okay. So, if we have this state, then observers at infinity will find a thermal bath of radiation in the same way that inertial observers, sorry, in the same way that accelerated observers experience thermal radiation in Minkowski space. On the other hand, well, we still haven't sorted out which is really the physically correct state. And I'm not going to have time to say as much about this as I had hoped, but we'll begin. So let's remember, well, actually, we can guess which one I'm going to claim is best by looking at my analogy. After all, in the Rindler case, we liked the Minkowski vacuum a lot better than the Rindler vacuum. Why was that? This state, recall, is singular on the horizon. Okay. Now, the way this comparison works is that it's a standard fact about black holes that the space-time near the horizon can be approximated as being exactly Rindler space, plus corrections that depend on the curvature scale of the black hole space-time. So we might expect, because physics is local, that indeed the correct analogy is going to be to say that this state acts an awful lot like the Rindler vacuum, plus corrections which corrections of order, something involving the curvature of the background spacetime. So in corrections of order, let's just say R, that's where R is here is supposed to of order the Riemann tensor in the background. Now, for a large astrophysical black hole, if I'm fairly close to the horizon, like 2 meters away or 1 meter away from the horizon, then these corrections are relatively small because the curvature scale is small. If you insist that I write a dimensionless quantity here, let me write this as the Riemann tensor, which has units of 1 over length squared times the distance to the horizon squared. And then probably I should take a square root out here. Okay. So if I'm close to the horizon, these corrections are small. So I should therefore expect that if I ask a question like, what is the stress energy in this state near the horizon, that it's given by the stress energy in this state plus small corrections. And indeed, that's what a more careful argument would show. So what does that mean? This means that we're going to have this piece near the horizon has a stress energy that diverges to minus infinity. So if this diverges to minus infinity, no matter what small correction I add to it, the stress energy of this state is also going to diverge to minus infinity. So we conclude that this state is one such that if I consider a renormalized stress energy tensor, that this is something which near the horizon is basically, again, minus the stress energy of a thermal bath in a gravitational field. And therefore goes to minus infinity at the horizon. Okay. Yes? So what we're doing now is we're considering a quantum field, free quantum field, propagating on a black hole background. Okay? So we're not including, we haven't coupled this field dynamically to gravity. We're not including what's called back reaction. Okay. So the right way to say this is there are various excuses, there are various reasons to see why this is a poor choice of state for the quantum field, a physically unnatural state. One is to say that, it seems to be very singular. Maybe that's not good. But the other is to look at this in terms of the initial value problem. After all, in some sense, which quantum state you start with is a matter of the initial conditions for the universe, right? So let's think about the initial conditions for the exterior universe. Then I could set up the initial conditions back here on scry minus and maybe here along the horizon. Okay. What we've noticed is that this quantum state is something with a diverging stress energy here at the horizon, okay, where, as I think you're pointing out, our approximation of neglecting gravitational back reaction breaks down. Okay. So what this is saying is that we certainly have no controlled approximation in which we could convince anyone that this is the correct state for the black hole, because we can't set it up without worrying about whether gravitational back reaction destroys the state completely. Okay. So for all those reasons, this is not a good choice of state for the black hole. Now, this one, on the other hand, is a fine choice of state. This is one that, again, we should expect to behave much like the Minkowski vacuum, plus small corrections, say, near the horizon. So the Minkowski vacuum had zero stress energy tensor. So we therefore expect the stress energy tensor in this state is small near the horizon and physically nice. So at least at that level, this is a much nicer choice of state than the top one. All right, let me say a couple more things, because my time is definitely near an end. These two states have names that you'll hear referred to in the literature. This one up here is called the Boulware state. This one down here is called the Hartle-Hawking state. Okay. What I've just argued is that the Boulware state is singular on the horizons, whereas the Hartle-Hawking state is not singular on the horizons. Okay. On the other hand, you might have liked the Boulware state near infinity, because by construction, it's a vacuum state defined with creation annihilation operators associated with inertial observers at infinity. So it's a state which is, so the Boulware state is a state which is empty at infinity. But what's the story about the Hartle-Hawking state at infinity? Well, as we've said, it looks like a thermal excitation over the Boulware state. So what that means is that if you stand off at infinity in this state, you detect particles. But let's also talk about its stress energy. Okay. This is a thermal excitation over the Boulware state. So what that means is if I take the expectation value of the stress energy tensor in, let me now call it, the Hartle-Hawking state, okay, that should be the stress energy tensor for our thermal bath in a gravitational field, plus the stress energy tensor back. And the Boulware state. Now, I'll wave my hands a little bit more, but I hope in a convincing way. This was something that we saw was singular near the horizon, because it had to, well, because it's minus this near the horizon. But what is it near infinity? Well, near infinity, as we've said, this Boulware state is just the state that coincides with the usual notion of vacuum state defined by inertial observers at infinity. So you would therefore expect that as we go to infinity, this term here goes to zero as we go to infinity, as r goes to infinity. Okay. But what about this term? Well, it just goes to be the stress energy tensor of a thermal bath of radiation at some temperature. Oh, and at what temperature? Well, the temperature, just like in the Rindler case, was kappa over 2 pi. So the temperature is constant. So near infinity, this thing, in fact, does not has a non-zero energy density. Near infinity, this thing has the energy density of a uniform thermal bath. Okay. So from the standpoint, well, OK. So now let's ask the question. Is the Hartle-Hawking vacuum a reasonable state for the quantum field to be in. Could you imagine setting up this state? Well, it kind of depends, right? Because if you really took me if you really took this literally, you tried to set up the Hartle-Hawking state in an asymptotically flat space-time, you'd have this uniform density of thermal radiation stretching off to infinity. If I fill up an infinite volume of space with a uniform energy density, I am also, again, not justified in neglecting gravitational back reaction, right? Because it will curve space, turn it into an FRW cosmology, and something else happens. Okay. So strictly speaking, in asymptotically flat space-time, this state is not so great either. However, the difference between the two is that this one suffers from a kind of ultraviolet problem. It's a UV problem. Whereas this one suffers from a kind of an IR problem. And as we know, there are lots of ways to deal with IR divergences and get physically useful answers out of them. You can just put the system in a box, for example, right? So what is the Hartle-Hawking state? The Hartle-Hawking state is an approximate description of what you'd get if you took a black hole, okay, and you put it in, for example, a large spherical cavity. So imagine this is a large spherical cavity, and this is some spherical reflecting wall, like a mirror, spherical mirror, or perhaps spherical mirror, or a spherical thermal bath. Thermodynamics, the big things that heat, reservoir, that's what I'm looking for, thank you. Or a spherical thermal reservoir. And spelling reservoir is not going to be a strong suit for me, but you'll figure it out. Okay. So by sort of putting in an IR cutoff, putting the system in a box, we can make sense of the Hartle-Hawking state. Similarly, and in a fashion that is of interest to many people here doing string theory, if you put the black hole not in asymptotically flat space, but instead in anti-de Sitter space, which acts much like a finite-sized box, it also imposes an IR cutoff and makes the Hartle-Hawking state something physically reasonable we can imagine setting up. So the moral of the story is that while there's no way I can imagine setting up the Boole-Weir state for my black hole, and if I'd had more time, we'd have gone through that in more detail. So feel free to ask me over the next few weeks when you see me. In contrast, the Hartle-Hawking state is something I can imagine setting up over a large volume of space, or say an anti-de Sitter space, so long as I have some kind of thermal reservoir, or if I simply allow the black hole to sit inside, say, some spherical mirror and to come to equilibrium. I can imagine setting that up. So finally, I should say one more phrase, which is say, all right, what happens then if we really do have asymptotically flat space? Well, in essence, what we've seen so far is that in terms of looking at an initial value problem, that's in terms of setting up a quantum state, the Boole-Weir state was nice out here. The Boole-Weir state was nice near infinity, and in particular, near past infinity. You can imagine setting up that part of the Boole-Weir state. It just says there's no particles coming in. What we couldn't imagine setting up was this diverging piece of the Boole-Weir state here on the horizon. On the other hand, the Hartle-Hawking state is something we can easily imagine setting up here, because there it's just some smooth state, nothing very complicated. It was out here that we have problems setting it up, because there's the infrared divergence with all kinds of gravitational back reaction. So the Hartle-Hawking state is nice near the past horizon. Okay. So what we do, or what one can do, to define a really nice state in asymptotically flat space is just to basically split things in terms of outgoing and ingoing modes. And you just think a little bit about how to do that, taking these backscattering into account, but it can be done. The result is something you can define called the unruh state. What is the unruh state? The unruh state is, roughly speaking, the thing which is the Hartle-Hawking state here, and therefore roughly the Hartle-Hawking state for outgoing modes, but the Boole-Ware state over here, and therefore roughly the Boole-Ware state for ingoing modes. Okay. So this, this combination hybrid state, oh gosh, as someone who's been watching Clifford's lectures, I'm tempted to call it a heterotic state, but that would be misleading. This hybrid state, which does one thing for outgoing modes, another thing for ingoing modes, is called the unruh state. And it's something which is, which you can imagine, I cheated a little bit, but you can ask me about this later. It's something you can imagine setting up. And it has the property that it's a smooth state, actually, at past infinity, at future infinity, and also on the future horizon. That hybrid state is the kind of thing that we do expect physically to arise when a black hole forms by collapse of a star in asymptotically flat spacetime. And it results in, as I say, no flux of particles going in, but a flux of particles, and therefore a thermal flux of stress energy going out towards plus infinity. That's the Hawking radiation. Okay. The last thing I'll mention, I need another picture to draw this. Well, I'll just say it. As I say, the unruh state is something that acts like the Boole-Ware vacuum with respect to the modes going in. And therefore, there is, with respect to the ingoing modes, there is some part of this negative energy that we talked about as being in the Boole-Ware vacuum and in the Rindler vacuum. What happens in the unruh state is there is a negative flux of stress energy in this direction of a spacetime. It's a negative sort of thermal flux if you view it in the right way. So the story about Hawking, about evaporation of black holes that someone asked about, is that now it would seem that if we turn back on the coupling to the gravitational field, what we see is that in the unruh state, stress energy flows away from the black hole towards plus infinity, while negative stress energy flows into the black hole. And if negative energy flows into the black hole, indeed the black hole should shrink. And eventually, something interesting should happen to it, probably in the domain outside of what we can analyze using quantum field theory in Kerr spacetime. So I think that's the right place for me to stop. Thank you very much. You're not a black hole. Okay, thank you very much. Be here for two more weeks, so any students who wish to ask questions about my somewhat rushed presentation of Hawking radiation will have 2 weeks to catch me. What's that? Signs. Don't ask me about the signs. Okay, thanks.